Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Today, I'd like to thank very much Ocean View Publishing in Longboat Key, Florida, for their support of this station. Pat and Bob Gusson are fantastic people. They've been honored by so many different organizations for their dedication and their interest in developing, in introducing debut writers, and have come out with some of the best stories ever. Today, they send me one of their top writers, Samuel W. Galey. Sam is with me all the way from the Orcas Islands in the Pacific Northwest, where he told me in the green room that they just had 10 inches of snow on his small island. But let me tell you a little bit more about him. He loves living where he does, although he's originally from Pennsylvania. He's written a few books now. They're suspenseful mysteries and intriguing studies of human nature. And I will agree with that. His voice is very unique for his characters. His dialogue just snaps. He previously worked in film production, would like to be a screenwriter, writing and developing shows. He is also one of the founding board members of the Orcas Island Literary Festival and co-founder of Novel Lab, a free writing workshop for kids. I'm thrilled to welcome to Authors on the Air for the first time, Sam Galey. Sam, welcome to Authors on the Air. How are you?
Thanks. I'm wonderful. And like you said, we had snow a little while ago, and now we're getting the return of snow. So I'm watching it fall and slowly making everything white and beautiful here.
It is a hard thing for me to visualize an island getting snow, much the same as it's difficult for me to imagine snow in the desert, yet I know it happens. When I see pictures of snow on cactus, it's almost like someone photoshopped it. So, and I'm on the opposite end of the country from you in Southwest Florida, where our day was clear blue skies at 65, 70 degrees. And as we speak, I'm looking out onto the little pond where I live, where our alligator is lounging on the edge of the water. So we couldn't be more far apart, except for fact that you wrote a book called The Guilt We Carry, which was exceptional. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You know, we spoke a little bit in the green room, and as I mentioned in my introduction, dialogue for me is key in any book. I think it makes or breaks the story. If I can't read dialogue and know automatically which character is speaking to me, that's a huge speed bump. And yet, throughout this book, each of your characters has a very unique voice, so distinguishable that you never would have to say, Alice says this, Sinclair says this, Philip says that. You know who the character is by the vocabulary they use, the timbre and tone of their voice, the cadence. I almost can hear it in my mind when I'm reading. Was that your intention to make dialogue your star?
Well, you know, I certainly strive to, you know, when I write books, not to have to say Alice said, Sinclair replied.
Right.
Really want the dialogue to stand on its own so the reader knows who's speaking. So, hopefully I was able to capture that. And, you know, unique voices with characters, as a reader, you know, that just makes it so enjoyable, you know, to read dialogue that's fresh and real and very unique to that personality. So it was definitely, I attempted to do that.
So Philip and Sinclair are two bad guys, but they are two very different type of men. One is very educated. The other is kind of, I don't know, the troll, the sidekick, the pickup man, the what is the other man? I don't know. He's the small time thug that goes along with what his boss tells him to do. Is that correct?
Right. He doesn't necessarily think for himself, but he he relishes danger and doing awful things to people. Whereas Sinclair, you know, he's equally as shrewd and brutal, but you know, he's definitely a different character. He was, I gave him a backstory that he had a very troubling childhood. He stopped growing when he was around 12 or 13. So he's a very small man, but he's very educated. And like I said, even though he's very brutal, he's very polite, especially to people like waiters and waitresses and people in the service industry. And he shows, you know, kindness even, you know, so it's kind of, he's definitely a contradiction in many ways.
Yes, he is. Now, and here we are talking about the, quote, bad guys in the book, yet we've yet to talk about Alice O'Farrell from the book called The Guilt We Carry. Alice is a tragic figure as well. So this is a very, to me, a very literary noir story. Would that be an accurate way for me to describe it, do you think?
I love that description. Yeah, it's Alice is definitely a flawed character. I really like flawed characters, and especially your protagonists, have them make mistake after mistake and see how, you know, how they can dig their way out of it. And, you know, with someone like Alice, what I'm really drawn to, and it was something I was drawn to in my first book, where like a simple twist of fate can, you know, alter someone's life. And
yes.
Alice, when she was 15, something awful happened and it changed everything. And it pretty much destroyed her. And this story is part of her effort to redeem herself and forgive and let go of the guilt that she's been burdened with for a long time.
And yet, having said that, she looks at one moment where she thinks this is going to change everything and how horribly wrong she is.
Right. Yeah, she sees an opportunity. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, this is your day. I want you to speak. Go ahead and continue your thought, please.
Yeah, I mean, with Alice, you know, she does see this opportunity. It's really the catapult of the story where she has an opportunity to take some money that's not hers. And she thinks that, you know, her life is such a train wreck that maybe this will be the way for her to get back to normal. And in fact, you know, more so than running away from the villain, she's really just running away from her past. And
sure.
And the money doesn't do anything to solve or make her life better.
You know, when people say I'm changing locations, it's got to be better. And I think you drag your baggage with you anyway, unless you throw out the old bags. So it's such
right.
a metaphor for life anyway, this story, that sure, you can pack up your car and leave, but if you still got all that emotional and internal baggage, you really are just changing addresses. You're not really solving
right.
anything, are you?
It's the same reflection in the mirror, whether you're in China or Florida. You know, it's the same reflection.
Yes.
So that, yeah, it doesn't change a thing.
I'm very curious about how you decide on stories, how you decide which tale to tell. Are you a man who has all of these ideas floating around, or do they come to you fleetingly and you say, wait, I kind of like that one? What is it like for you to decide what you're going to write about?
You know, I'm definitely drawn to strong character-driven stories. So I think I really start with a character that I find interesting, and often, especially with my first book, Deep Winter, and then The Guilt We Carry, both of my protagonists were based on people that I knew or saw. Danny in Deep Winter, he suffered brain damage as a small child, and essentially as this 40-year-old man, he's this child in this man's body. And he's discovered with a dead body at the beginning of the story. And so that was what inspired me for Danny was, you know, I grew up with this kid in Pennsylvania that had a pretty severe learning disability. And he was just, you know, very different from the rest of us. And we gave him the space, and he was bigger and a little bit intimidating. And I just, years later, just wondered, you know, what happened to him. And then a story started to percolate, like, what would happen to my friend if he was discovered with a dead body? How would he explain? How would he redeem himself? How would he get out of this being accused of something that he didn't do? And then with the guilt we carry, you know, Alice, at the time I was living in Los Angeles, this is obviously a little different than living up here in Orcas Island.
Mm-hmm.
And in driving my daughter to school, I saw this young girl on the street. She was a runaway, probably 16 or 17. And I saw her a few different days, and it just, she stuck with me. Like, you know, how did this young girl, this kid, end up on the streets? You know, where did it go wrong? What happened?
Right.
And that was the catalyst for the idea for Alice. Someone that, you know, is in a place that they didn't necessarily want to be.
Right. And then comes the what if. And so, interesting, when you're talking about Deep Winter, and I'm thinking to myself as you're describing how this a boy who was very large and probably from a kid standpoint very scary, you didn't really know what was wrong with him, what type of an injury he had, and didn't know if he was nice or if he was, you know, mean or anything like that. So, and I think that's normal for kids anyway, no matter how enlightened we think we are or our parents might have been. So I'm imagining that. And then I'm imagining the way you described it was so perfect. You know, what if he's found with a dead body? How does someone who has those challenges defend himself if he's not got the wherewithal through an injury?
Right.
To understand even what the circumstances are. And then here we have Alice, who is also really pretty much a child the same way, who who's had this horrible, horrible family history. And no one's given her guidance on how to unwind all that and unpack it and become, you know, an emotionally stable person. So she does what she thinks is the right thing. How many people do you know who say, oh, if only, you know, if only I had this? It's really the very human condition that you've delved into here.
Yeah, I mean, with Alice, you know, when this thing happens when she's only 15, she thinks she's doing the right thing by running away from home because her presence in the house is just causing for her a constant reminder of what she played part of. And she can't bear it. And, you know, it's killing her parents. So she runs away, which is, you know, the first of many other mistakes. And, but yeah, it's an innocence, you know, loss of innocence for sure.
Yes.
For Alice.
And I think, you know, what you may be talking about is probably emblematic of what happens with many runaways who are teenagers who don't have the skills to, understand how to unwind the condition that they found themselves in or the position that they found themselves in or parents who don't for that matter. So interesting. Will you tell me a little bit about your writing history and how it is you became a writer and what your aspirations are going forward?
Well, yeah, I've always been drawn to, you know, reading and writing. My mother was an English teacher and just really helped inform me of the value of reading a book and just escaping into another tale, another life. So I just started writing short stories when I was young. And then when I was in college, I was an English major. And I really started off my writing, professional writing career. I moved to Los Angeles and I started in the film industry, and I started to write for 1 hour television with my wife, and then I sold some feature scripts. And, you know, although it was very satisfying and I did enjoy that aspect of writing, that part of my career, I just find writing a novel, the experience is so much more enjoyable. You know, it's my vision, it's my story. And of course you work with your editor and your agents and other people to give you some feedback on your work, but you know, you're driving the train by yourself pretty much.
Sure.
Whereas in the film industry, you finish a product that might be rewritten many times by other people and it doesn't resemble what you had turned in. So it's not quite as personally satisfying for me.
Well, sure, only you have your vision, but somebody else has an overall vision that may take parts of your vision and incorporate it. What is the most important thing you learned from your experience in Hollywood about writing?
About writing, you know, I really think pacing is, I walked away with the importance of pacing in a story. But, you know, it's, and when you're writing the screenplay, you know, it's really formulaic. Things need to happen at minute 25 or 30. They need to happen at minute 60, the crisis point. So there's a sense of pacing. And then when I was writing Deep Winter, you know, I wanted the reader to keep flipping the page and not be able to put it down. And I've had a lot of people tell me that both of these books feel very cinematic. So I think I have carried that over from my experience in Hollywood.
And again, I go back to, again, your dialogue, and perhaps that's where it comes from, because you know, you don't have bubbles over a character's head when you're watching film, whether it's on the small screen or the big screen. You have to listen to the voices, not only what they sound like, but what they're saying, to recognize who they are. So, and also, there's a lot to be said for leaving the stuff out that stops the forward motion of a story, isn't there? And I think in script and screenwriting, you really are not concerned about the color of a dress unless it's germane to the particular scene. Am I incorrect or correct on that?
No, absolutely. You know, with a screenplay, what's most important is your dialogue. You know, you set up your location, whether it's a house or a trailer, and you paint the picture a little bit, but it's your dialogue and your character development that's king, and that, you know, that will sell a story.
Because the dialogue is also action, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, it's dialogue, whether it's a romantic comedy or a horror story, you know, it's action. I mean, the dialogue, you know, there needs to be conflict. You know, if you're reading or watching a romantic comedy, there's got to be conflict between the two people or the three people. It's conflict is action. It creates something that intrigues the viewer or the reader.
Besides the physicality of action, in other words.
Right.
It explains, I think, why we're seeing the physicality of action and why it's happening. So it's interesting. I keep going back to the story and how authentic it feels to me. You've encapsulated in 300 pages the human condition. I have to say that again. It's a remarkable piece of work. Will you be working on another book anytime soon? And if so, are you going to continue to write standalone, Sam?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm nearly finished with my next book. I'm at the probably 80% completion rate, but then, of course, I need to do a lot of rewriting and pulling the story together. And, you know, I'm definitely, as a reader, I like standalone books. The one thing I am doing with my new story is I'm returning to the same community, the same town that Deep Winter took place in, and a different time frame, but there'll be a few characters from that book that I'm bringing back into this one. And this is definitely a challenge for me as a writer. This is a mystery, and as I've been writing it, I have newfound respect for mystery writers, because with the books that I've written, thriller suspense stories, often you know who your antagonist is. You know who's dangerous. And with a mystery, you don't necessarily know who is in danger and who might pose that danger. So it's been a fun exercise for me, and I'm almost there.
So I want to ask you just a few questions kind of on a shorter version. When you're writing your characters, you know, you've gone from 15, 16-year-old Alice here. How did you know her POV. How did you get into her head and you were sure that what you were she was saying were not your words, that they were actually hers? Is that a difficult thing for a writer to do?
It was, I'll speak for myself as the writer of this one. It's, you know, when you're writing, you know, I'm a male author, and I decided to write about, you know, she starts as a 15-year-old girl, and in the story, most of the story centers around her being 21. So I definitely did a lot of, you know, this a lot of reading books that inspired me that were female-driven stories. And the thing I do like about Alice, you know, she's not a huge talker. You know, she's a bit silent just because of a lot of different reasons.
The trauma
and in
that
some,
she's had, yes.
It sounds strange, but in some ways I envisioned a young female version of Clint Eastwood. You know, kind of a quiet character that trouble seems to find them. And often doesn't have to speak a lot in order to get across what she's thinking or feeling.
I would imagine, because she's particularly a loner, and that makes sense that she is, because of this crazy childhood that she's had. When you are writing dialogue, do you read it out loud to yourself or have someone read it back to you?
You know, I'm in a writer's group, so I do a little bit of that, and it's incredibly difficult to sometimes read dialogue because you're play acting. So I don't rely on that, but I'm a massive rewriter, so I just go back and not only rewrite action and description and those kind of things, but this dialogue, this really finessing it. And with Alice, I took a lot of care, and like we were speaking earlier with Sinclair, my villain, once I got on a roll with how he spoke, it really did start to become natural. So it wasn't Samuel, the writer, speaking, it was Sinclair.
You mentioned at the beginning of the show that you start with a character, and that's how your book develops around that character. Does your character change as you're writing?
They definitely do for me. You know, I definitely start with an outline. You know, I develop my character, you know, where they grew up, and their weaknesses, their strengths, their fears and insecurities. So I really kind of have an idea as I start to physically write them. But, you know, they evolve. You know, so, you know, the outline does shift because the characters, as I get to know them better, they start to make decisions that make more sense for the character, mm-hmm. not where the writer wants them to get to. They definitely evolve and change for me.
So interesting that you're saying that. I had a occasion to speak with the wonderful Brad Taylor a couple weeks ago. His new book is called Daughter of War, and the book started off with one scene, a very short scene, with a child of war, child in a war-torn country. And he said it was going to be a disposable character. And he said that as he started writing the book, keeping that character in mind, it actually became obvious to him that the child was the story. And so he named the book Daughter of War because of that character. So I find it fascinating that you start with an idea of who this protagonist is going to be, and she presents herself to you as you're telling her story. Is that true?
Definitely. You know, and in early draft, I had some completely different characters that didn't work for the story. There's one character, there's a character, Elton, that is kind of Alice's sage. You know, he's very wise and kind to her when she needs that kindness. And that character was a dramatically different character, and it just wasn't working with the relationship with Alice. And I just created this older gentleman that lives in a small town in North Carolina, and how their lives intersect. And it just, to me, it just made the story that much stronger. So yeah, sometimes characters, your circumstances character was, I guess, was thought disposable, but then it became absolutely vital. And other times you find out that characters aren't maybe necessarily to your story.
Well, I first of all want to congratulate you on a beautifully written book. It's magnificent, and I totally enjoyed it. It was such a joy to read. Will you please tell everyone where they can find you on the webs and in social media?
Yeah, well, I have an author website. It's samuelwgailey.com. And that's at my same hashtag for, you know, Twitter and Facebook as well, Samuel W. Gailey.
Well, Samuel W. Gailey, I have had such an enjoyable evening talking to you. And I wish you all success with this book. From everything I see, people are loving it. You know, your reviews are excellent. And I hope it continues to be a big hit for you. I know it was just recently released, so, you know, we still have time on that. But I want to encourage everyone, you can find The Goat We Carry by Samuel W. Gailey in brick and mortar and online stores. Please go and check it out. And then if you finish this one and love it as much as I did, you're going to want to read A Deep Winter, Deep Winter, which is another novel by Sam Gailey. Sam, thank you so much for being with me. I hope when the next book is done, you'll come back again and visit.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would love to talk about the next one. If you like the first two, I think you'll be intrigued by the next one. So
I think I really probably will be. And I want to also thank Ocean View Publishing for supporting this show. They are just lovely people there. Everyone is like a family to me. I love them. They're just a few hours north of where I live, and I'm very lucky that I get to see them often. Samuel W. Gailey, thank you again. I wish you all success with your writing career, and I'll be speaking to you again next year, I bet you, when your new book comes out.
Thanks so much, Pam. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun today.
Thank you. It's been my absolute pleasure. And listeners, thank you for being with me. And thank you, Mom and Dad. I'll see you later. Bye-bye.